Hello and welcome to show 28 of the Mises UK podcast with me, Andy Duncan, here in Henley-on-Thames in Regatta Week. This morning I'm going to be talking with the fabulous Professor Guido Hulsmann, who is from the University of Angers in France. He's also one of the leading figures in Austrian economics and a senior fellow at the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. As well as this, he's author of The Ethics of Money Production and one of my favourite non-fiction books, the brilliant Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism, which reads like a crime novel. And I urge everyone to get a copy of this book if you haven't read it already. Today we're going to talk about a new forthcoming book that Guido's working on, based on the concept of a free lunch, or rather, the political economy of gratuitousness. Or as the Americans would say, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. Guten Morgen, Guido.
Guten Morgen, mein lieber Andy.
Oh, fantastisch. Und wie geht es dir?
Mir geht es sehr gut heute Morgen, obwohl das Wetter in Alabama nicht besonders gut ist.
Ist es sehr heiß und nass?
Es ist wolkig und heiß und nass wie immer im Juli.
Oh, yeah. I have to go to English, but I spent a few weeks in August in Alabama once, and I know exactly how you're feeling. Okay, brilliant. So, to business. This book that you're working on, do you have a working title for it yet, and when will it be out?
Well, I hope it will be out by the end of the year. The working title is The Economics of Free Lunches.
That sounds like a pretty good title for a book. Now, Pope Benedict XVI, my favourite recent pope, he spoke a few years ago about gratuitousness. We're going to have to change that word, by the way. It's too difficult to say. In one of his encyclicals, he talked about how it should relate to economics. Is that what inspired your book?
Yeah, exactly. That was the initial motivation, right? So because he had this cyclical, which he moved from the divine gifts that God gives to humanity, well, all of creation, right? So we can benefit from the earth, but also divine gifts of love, which bestows on us divine graces of all sorts. So all of this comes for free, right? We don't exchange with God. We're just on the receiving end. And of course, gifts also play a role, a fundamental role, for example, in family life, right? Children could not grow up if it were not for the gifts, material gifts, but also emotional, spiritual gifts and so on that parents joyfully and voluntarily bestow on them. So the Pope then raised the question, well, to what extent does this principle of gratuitousness, does it play a role in the economy, and especially in the market economy? And to what extent should it play a role in the market economy? Now, of course, it's easy to come from such a question to hear interventionist subtones, right? That you see, well, we have the market economy, which is based on exchange, and should it not be complemented? Should it not be enriched by gratuitous services provided by the government and so on? Now, this is not what the Pope had personally in mind, but of course he didn't exclude it either. But clearly he had this conception that the market economy is some sort of an exchange, is based on the exchange of equivalence, right? So the market per se does not involve an element of gratuitousness. And that, of course, piqued my interest because as an Austrian economist, you're familiar with the notion that in any exchange, both parties benefit, right? So there is always a win-win situation in a market exchange so that both benefit, even though your intention might not be that the other person benefit. So I thought that Austrian economists might have something useful to say about how the principle of gratuitousness plays out in a market economy. And that was the initial motivation for writing this book.
Yes, the old equal sign again, isn't it, from Keynesianism? They have to have the equal signs because it makes the mathematics work.
Well, it's actually much older than Keynesianism, right? It goes back to antiquity.
Given that we all have limited time and there's several other books you could have written, what made this particular one so important to you that this is the next book you were going to write?
Well, my first reflex was not to write a book on this when the encyclical came out in 2009, because I was involved with capital theory and other subjects. And so my reflex was then to hand this over to a doctoral student of mine. And indeed, so I found somebody who was by upbringing naturally qualified and interested in the subject, namely a Catholic nun. So a sister, Catherine Badolo, she was working on this subject from 2011 through 2015, and she wrote a very nice French language dissertation on l'économie de la gratuité, so the economics of gratuitousness. Well, this is a beginner's work, but she did a very fine job researching so the history of the concept and how it also came to be discussed and manifested in economics, and then had a nice part also discussing the theoretical conceptions on this. And I myself then, a year after she graduated, so I returned to this because I was invited to give a Lou Church lecture at the Austrian Scholars Conference here in Alabama. And I chose this subject as a topic because also, I mean, was I had just good readings on this. And I thought, well, I can myself contribute a few more thoughts on this, things that she didn't cover or had not covered sufficiently. So that's what I did in this lecture, in the Lou Church lecture. In the Lou Church lecture, I talked especially about what I call the spontaneous production of gratuitous goods. Right? So the spontaneous production of free lunches within the market economy, and how such free lunches can be destroyed, and how they are both in legitimate and illegitimate ways. So that was the subject of the lecture. Now, at the beginning of this year, 2018, I was afforded the opportunity to, well, spend a lot of time on a writing project of my choice, because I'm on a sabbatical semester. So I planned initially to work on a book on finance, political economy of finance, and said, okay, well, but before I get to this, let's just finish this little project that I had started in 2016, this lecture ministry. Let's just brush it up a little bit and bring it, make it ready for publication. So I plan to invest on this a month or so of work, but Andy, it's just terrible. It took me 5 months to write this book. It's still not quite finished, but it's now in the working stage. So I quadrupled the size of the initial manuscript, and now it's a nice book that should be around 200 pages or so in print.
Sounds like the making of the Lord of the Rings or the making of The Hobbit. Now, seeing as the original dissertation was written by a nun, are you also going to talk about things like truth and love and God and so on?
No, not actually, because that's not really my field. I'll have a little discussion, little presentation of Caritas in Veritate, so that the reader gets an impression about the starting point. But this is not really something that economists are particularly suitable to pontificate on.
Now, you mentioned spontaneous gratuitousness. We've probably all got the concept in our minds of basic gratuitousness. I see a person in the street who looks hungry, and I give them a £10 note, and hopefully they spend it on food to feed themselves, and I just walk away. But can you explain what spontaneous gratuitousness is?
Yeah, so this is spontaneous gratuitousness. The word spontaneous in Austrian economics has been introduced by Hayek. And Hayek distinguished between intentional and unintentional consequences of human action. Okay, so all human actions have intended and unintended consequences. And in the case of gratuitousness, if there's intentional gratuitousness, we call this a gift. Right, you give money to a beggar in the street, right? You want to hand over your property to his benefit, and that is your intention, so you do it. But sometimes we provide gratuitous goods even though we do not intend to do this. Sometimes we are unconscious of the fact that we're providing gratuitous goods, and sometimes we do not particularly like it, but we cannot help avoiding it. And that is unintentional or spontaneous gratuitousness. Now, spontaneous gratuitousness, like spontaneous all other effects, right, are of course of the greatest importance in economics. Right? As you know, in economics, that's precisely the difference between a good economist and a bad economist. The good economist looks on both types of consequences, whereas the bad economist only looks on what people would like to be the consequence of their action, but usually it doesn't stop there. And very often, well, in policy analysis, we're dwelling on the negative and unintended consequences, like in government interventionism of all sorts, right? The government intends to improve the conditions for the working class by imposing minimum wage rates, but what in fact they do is to improve the living conditions for a few beneficiaries, namely those who keep their jobs at the higher wage rates, whereas they deteriorate the conditions for many other people, right? So there we stress the negative unintended consequences that follow from it. So in my book now on gratuitousness or free lunches, so I stress so the positive external effects, right? So the free gifts that it's not really a gift because not intended, but the free benefits that result from human action, even though we might not intend to provide such gratuitous benefits to other people.
And can you give us an example then of spontaneous gratuitousness?
Yeah. So the most basic example is the one that I already alluded to, is in an exchange, right? You go buy bread in a bakery. You pay a dollar for the bread. Then as Pope Benedict and most other, or many other people see it, well, what you have here is an exchange of equivalence, right? But as we know from Condillac in the 18th century and a few scholastics that's already pointed it out in the 16th and 17th century, and of course that's a central tenet of Austrian economics, is in an exchange both parties benefit. Right? What I give always has for me, what I give up in an exchange has for me a lower value than that what I receive. Now, so I necessarily benefit in the exchange and I benefit the other party, even though I might not wish this to be the consequence of my action. Maybe I just want to give to the baker the exact equivalent of his bread, but I cannot avoid benefiting him through our exchange. Right? So that's spontaneous gratuitousness. Let me give you another example. Let's say you are when you're hoarding money, right? So you're stockpiling money. Very often such stockpiling is driven by very what you would call egoistical motivations, right? You just anticipate trouble ahead, so you want to protect your portfolio by making it more liquid, so you're selling certain things and you're hoarding cash. Now, hoarding cash has the consequence that so less money is being exchanged on the market, so money becomes in the exchanges relatively more scarce as compared to other goods. Therefore, there's a tendency for money prices to fall. Right? So there's a price deflationary effect. This price deflationary effect is beneficial for all other money users who, unlike you, have not decided to stockpile their money but still use it in exchange. So your saving in the form of cash has as a consequence to provide greater purchasing power to the money units being used by all other people. Now, this is so irrespective of whether you wish this to be the case or not. Right? You are bestowing additional purchasing power to other people, whether you like it or not.
Oh, I see. That's a nice example there. Now, this must really upset the Keynesians then, because they see money hoarding as the greatest evil in the world.
Yeah.
And also they have the equal sign, don't they? So they think, I give a dollar for a loaf of bread, I'm receiving a loaf of bread worth a dollar, and the baker is receiving a dollar for something that he gave away for a dollar. So no one's getting anything more than a sandwich out of that. So how do we reconcile those two views then? How does Keynesian economics survive when it obviously isn't matching up to the real world? And why doesn't Austrian economics prosper when it obviously matches the real world?
Well, I mean, Keynesian economics has some plausibility because if you reason from a microeconomic perspective, you might know that the way Keynesian economics is sold to undergraduate students is typically by reference to the fallacy of composition. Right? When you say, well, there are certain things that are beneficial from an individual point of view, but are not beneficial from an aggregate point of view. Right? So, for example, so that's a basic logical fallacy, right? You cannot generalize all things that hold true for a part of a whole to the whole as such, right? I mean, you cannot say, for example, I might improve my view if I'm a visitor in a movie theater, right? And there's this big guy sitting in front of me and I don't see the screen very well, then I might stand up in order to improve my vision of the screen. But of course, that's a solution for me individually, but then I create a problem for somebody else, right? So it's not a problem for the whole room, right? Because not everybody can improve his view by just standing up. And so the Keynesians then hop from there and say, well, look, in economics, so we have the same thing. Therefore, you cannot reason purely from a microeconomic point of view. You have to take into account the aggregate repercussions of individual behavior, right? And so, for example, you can enrich yourself by greater savings, but the aggregate consequences that follow from increased savings are contrary to what they mean for the individual, right? The individual can increase his own wealth by saving more, but from the point of view of the economy as a whole, this is very detrimental.
Oh, I like that, because then the spontaneous gratuitousness is actually improving everyone else's ability because it's making their money worth more.
Exactly, right. But you see, I mean, I would just want to explain why Keynesian is, because that was your question, right? Why do the Keynesians stay in business, right? And one reason is because it's superficially plausible when you reason from a microeconomic point of view. Indeed, Keynesian economics, contrary to what many Keynesians think of themselves, is not good theory of the economy as a whole. It is just illicit generalization of purely microeconomic reasoning. Indeed, if you look at the economy from the point of view of an individual firm and you say, okay, what makes my business go better? Well, it's when people spend more money on my products. Now, that's correct. Okay. So, but what Keynesians then do is to say, well, the more money people spend on offers a product, the better it is for the economy as a whole. That's a fallacy. And it's precisely the kind of fallacy that they think is prevalent in classical economics. And they think you cannot licitly generalize the benefits of savings. They only hold true in their eyes for individuals, but not for the economy as a whole. Whereas it is exactly wrong, right, in that case, because savings are beneficial not only for individuals, but also for society as a whole. But money spending is only beneficial from an individual point of view, and you cannot generalize this for the economy as a whole. That's precisely the whole point of Adam Smith, the point for which he became famous, is that he had illustrated, well, actually, it doesn't matter how much money in aggregate is spent in the economy. That does not make the economy richer. And what makes the economy richer is increased division of labor and increased capital accumulation, but not spending more money.
Getting to another fallacy then, there's a fallacy in society that the government is Santa Claus or St. Nicholas.
Right.
Because they keep giving away gifts, but there's three conditions for a gift, isn't there? You own the thing you're giving away.
Yes.
The donor is not expecting to pay you anything. Yes. And also the beneficiary must agree. Now, the government breaks all three of these things when it gives its gift, because it gives its gifts from taxation or counterfeiting, fiat money. Obviously, it expects benefits back. So when it gives you welfare, it expects you to be complacent about society, and it also expects you to vote for the government. And also, as well, it forces gifts onto us. It forces gifts onto us like diversity and minimum wages and all these other things. Are you going to expose these fallacies within the book too?
Yes, so I'll discuss this. I have a lengthy chapter on government interventionism relating to the gift economy, right? So what governments always do is, I mean, by their very nature, right, modern governments cannot make gifts. They cannot make free gifts, right? Because they really, all the things that they transfer to other people, they do not own, as you have already pointed out, right? So, and of course, then it cannot be a free gift. It's an unconditional transfer, but it's not really a gift in the narrow sense of the word, right? So it's always a perverted gift. And these gifts then, of course, when they come from the government, they have various other qualities that I discuss in the book. For example, they tend to be sterile, contrary to private gifts. And when you have private persons giving to one another, for example, to people in need, right, you're helping out a relative or a good friend, or sometimes not even a good friend, but just a neighbor, something, you're helping them out for a while because they're in distress. And the point is, of course, that this relief that you provide privately is meant to improve their condition, right? It's just temporary, and it helps them over a difficult moment so that they can eventually stand on their own feet. But what government gifts do systematically is to encourage people not to change anything to their condition, because they, especially if there's an entitlement to the sort of transfer that they receive from the government, and in that case, well, there's no incentive at all to change anything to their current condition, to change anything to their attitude. So what the gift then does is actually to throw them into dependency, make them dependent from the government, and become increasingly incapable of changing anything from their to the situation, right? So that's what I call a sterile gift.
Yeah, so they're taking taxes off me so I can't buy an Aston Martin, and then they're putting somebody into a poverty trap. So well done, the government. Now, another gift that governments give out is they give out the gift of copyright and the gift of patents and so on. Are you going to try to link intellectual property into this gratuitousness as well?
Well, indirectly, to the effect that intellectual property rights are a very efficient way of destroying spontaneous gratuitousness in the market. If you have a process of technological improvements, as for example, think of the phone industry, right? The smartphones that we have today are the result not of one grand design that was somehow hacked out 25 years ago and then put into practice, but it's the result of technological ping-pong process, right? One firm contributes one element, so they create the newest or most recent version of the cell phone, and then comes another firm and sees, okay, how can we take this product and carry it further? And so they add another little component. You have this ping-pong going on, it's involving multiple players, and at the end of this process, you get something very complex, very advanced, like the modern smartphone. Right. If you had introduced intellectual property rights at any moment of this process, and so as to prevent any competitor from using what you have just created, then of course the whole process could not have taken place. Right. What intellectual property rights then do is to stimulate product innovations. That's one thing. But then especially also what they do is they prevent that other people emulate what you have just done, imitate, let's put it starkly, right, put it in stark terms, to imitate what you have just done, and therefore make the product or the technological improvement available to a broader customer base. Right? In a competitive market process in which you have no intellectual property rights, technological improvements rapidly spread to all consumers, and they cannot be cashed on by the people who brought them in first. Right? I mean, they can be cashed on at the beginning for a little while, but these monopoly profits dissipate very quickly in the competitive process. Right. So very quickly in a competitive process, right, all benefits resulting from technological improvements come to benefit people who have not themselves contributed anything to this creation. Right. So as a matter of fact, then technological improvements in a free market tend up to be spontaneous gratuitousness for the rest of mankind. What intellectual property laws do is to concentrate the benefits on a small number of people, and thereby so they internalize these spontaneous benefits or these spontaneous gratuitousness and make them benefit only a restricted circle of beneficiaries. Right? So that's what intellectual property rights do.
Yeah, so nice. It kind of ties spontaneous competition together with evolution, doesn't it? Because imagine if the insects had got a patent on wings. So now we wouldn't have flying squirrels, and we wouldn't have birds, and we wouldn't have flamingos and all sorts of things. So it's a nice link there between the two ideas of evolution and spontaneous market improvement. Now, I think we've covered most of the areas in the book, but is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about that's going to be in the book?
Eventually came around and discussing the economics of gifts in more detail than I had initially planned. So finally, eventually, so I've come to spend quite a few pages on gifts. And what I do in particular is to stress the connection between gifts and the market economy, right? So the complementary nature between the gift economy and the market economy. The two grow together and the two decline together. Gifts provide complementary services to which are absolutely necessary for all people who cannot live off their own labor, right? Handicapped people, children, very old people, and so on, right? They all depend on the gift economy. But gifts also then provide all kinds of services that cannot be provided, at least at present, by the market, right? That's the very function of gifts. Another point that I also discuss in some detail, much more than I had initially understood, is the connection between private property and gratuitousness. And if you do not have private property, there can be no gratuitous goods. For something to be gratuitous, it must come in excess of what you presently own, of what you presently have a right to, right? If I give a gift to a beggar in the street, it's a gift precisely because it was not his, right? He didn't have any claim on the dollar bill that I give to him. So that's why it is a gift. If he had a claim, let's say if we were in a communist system or something like this, and everybody owned an equal share of all things, then I could not possibly make him a gift, because anything that were in my wallet would, at least to some extent, have been his in the first place. You see my point? So I can give a gift only if there is a separation between mine and thine. If this separation is absent, there is no gift.
So if there's no private property, it's just tax and welfare, and we're removing all the goodness in society, aren't we? Because you're not being good and giving somebody something, you're just being made to, and then you'll come to resent the other person. So we'll just create a more evil society. Now, I know you're a very busy man, but we do have a couple of listeners' questions who've written in and want to ask you a couple of questions. So going completely off topic, Aaron Carland and Robin Hart Bunting, they want to know, Why do the Germans put up with the inflation of the euro? And coming on from that, how long before you think the euro is going to collapse?
The Germans are putting up with this inflation because they want the European Union to work. And now, why are the Germans, do they have such an obsession with the European Union? Well, I mean, this is a very complex issue. I mean, relates, of course, to some extent to the very disturbed relationship that Germans have with the German nationality, right, with their own nationhood. But, I mean, you can also say, well, in a way, maybe, well, the Germans just have also an obsession with increasing the power of their own nation, and they see that they can do this only by leveraging that power through a greater political unity. That seems to be also a motivation that comes from, that is very prevalent in France, right? In France, many people see the European Union just as a means to extend the power of the French nation state, and so on. I think so. I think this is the main motivation. As long as the Germans are, for one reason or another, infatuated with keeping the European Union, in fact, what one commentator, Paul Balian, at once called very aptly, the Kingdom of Brussels, as long as they want to keep this up at all price, well, then as long as that, it will just run.
Yeah. And how long do you think the euro will last then? Is it going to go in the next 10 years or?
As long as the Germans are ready to pay for it. I think it's as simple as this.
Fair enough. Now, just another couple of bits and pieces. We've got another question from Alexander Carlson, and he wonders how important you think Erich von Kühnert-Lehdin is, and whether somebody ought to write a book on him.
Kühnert-Lehdin is, he's been writing on areas on which I'm not an expert, so especially history, intellectual history, and so on. So I've heard myself a little bit on these issues. I've dabbled into this, but in a more restricted way. My impression is that Kühnert-Lehdin is more of a journalist than of a scholar. That's my impression. He's a very interesting writer. He is somebody who has a lot of ideas. You can learn a lot. You can be inspired by Kühnert-Lehdin. He's original. He is courageous in the expression of his opinions. But not everything that he has written down has been carefully researched. Right? So in that respect, I would say he's not an academic, because the job of an academic is, of course, to carefully verify each step of an argument or of a claim. And that's something that he did not do. So you can learn a lot from him. You can be especially inspired a lot from Kühnert-Lehdin, but he's not a completely reliable source in all respects. So should there be a book written on him, why not? I mean, if somebody loves him so much that he wants to spend time researching his life and writings, why not? It certainly doesn't merit it less than many of the other people on whom books are written these days.
Yeah, well, I love him to bits, but I have the mind of a butterfly, so I could never be methodical enough to write anything myself. Okay, thank you, Guido, then, for taking us through your book this morning. Is there anything else that you're working on that you'd like us to know about, such as liquidity culture or any other topics?
Yeah, I've been working on cultural consequences of inflationary fiat money regimes, especially relating to liquidity and so on. Well, this is still work in progress. I've been sidetracked by my work on this book on gratuitousness. But, well, maybe we can talk about these things in a later interview.
Excellent. Now, finally, in very methodical fashion, you dive-bombed me once from a very great height from a boat in the Mediterranean, and I've yet to repay the favour, and I'm kind of building myself up for that. Are you going to be coming along to Bodrum this year?
Not this year, because, I will be busy with... We are creating a new master's programme in Angers, my university, and it will start in September, so I cannot... go for the conference. And if I just went there for a day just to deliver the talk, it's not the same thing. This would have been the most that I could have done. But I plan to be there in 2019.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so make sure you're on the boat day, because I've got a little treat planned in store for you. Anyway, Guido, thank you very much for your time this morning. And I look forward to meeting you in person on a boat in 2019.
So do I, my dear Andy.
We hope you enjoyed today's show with Professor Guido Hulsmann on his new forthcoming book. I'm going to be taking a break from the Mises UK podcast for a while, as I'm going on an extended business trip to Asia, though I am hoping to persuade one of the Mises UK mighty team to take over the reins while I'm living it up on aeroplanes. Otherwise, I'll be back in late August to meet up with some more great people from the world of Austrian economics. Until we meet again, please enjoy your property and freedom. responsibly.